Hello.
Hi, it's me again.
Hi.
Okay, are you ready to continue?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Hey, so I want to ask you a little bit about relationships you've built. Now, I know you said that there are a lot of people that you still keep in contact with from the places you travel. Are there any special contacts, like, groups of women you met or anything like that?
Yes, absolutely. Like I mentioned before, when I lived in Abidjan, we were a part of a group called SOS Sisters Overseas. And I'm still, again, one of the key people in that group is the woman who eventually hired me to work in Tunisia. She went back and got her administrative credential and became principal. And so she's the one that hired me to come and work in Tunisia. Another member of that group was the woman who's here in Panama, Carolyn. We kept in touch over the years, not all the time, but through other friends. And so, again, that's a relationship that was developed back then. I'm also in touch with another one of the teachers. I was in the high school. She was in the lower school. And she eventually came to Tunisia to teach, and now she's back in Abidjan. So I'm still in touch with her and her mother and her daughter. She's Liberian, and they moved from Liberia during the time when they had the coup there. Her father used to be an ambassador, and so when the coup happened in Liberia, they moved next door to Ivory Coast. So she and her parents and family lived there for many, many years. So I'm still in touch with her, and I still have a friend that I met in Ivory Coast who is from Nigeria. Her husband was working at the bank. She and I are still friends. She lives in Atlanta, and whenever I go to Atlanta, I always see her. And we spend time together. So these are friendships that I developed 20 or so years ago. So we still have these friendships. The women that I met in Tunisia, we will always be friends. Always, always, always. I went back for the graduation this past summer, or past June, and it was just like I had just left the day before, and it had been really a year since I'd been there. And I communicate with them. We are on Facebook together, and I call them occasionally and chat with them, and they are planning to come here and visit me in Panama. And again, it's just that when I have met people in my travels, we usually do create a bond that keeps us connected.
Do you keep do you have any things that you've kept from your travels, like photos or
Oh yes,
have you
I
bought?
have photos, I have artifacts, I have literature, I have just everything. I'm one of these people, and I keep a journal. I keep a journal of I have really two journals. One is my Thanksgiving journal because every night before I go to bed, I try to write down at least five things that I'm thankful for that occurred that day. And then I have the other journal of just my thoughts and my musings and my, just the things that occupy my mind. And I write those down. But I do have journals that go back to, oh, long, long. I've got at least maybe eight journals that I have filled that I have kept over the years. And I have photos. I have things that people have given me. I mean, things that people have just given me, they are treasures to me, and I just keep them. I'm just looking at some of them right now because I have them hanging on a corkboard in my room. I have one is a necklace that this guy that I was involved with here in Panama, he wanted it. And as much as I love him, I just could not give it to him. But it's a hand carved. It's got one, two, three, six small hand carved wooden masks on it, and then it's a pendant, and the large part of it, I guess it's the dimensions. It's a necklace, but each face, each mask is individually carved and is distinctive from the others. And he really wanted that, and I said, I really would love to give it to you, but it was a gift to me that I cannot give you. And then I have another one that is a beaded headband from South Africa that a friend went there and visited and brought back for me. I have another one that is a Maasai wedding engagement band that you wear around your neck. And so, I mean, these are all things that people have given me. I have things that were given to me in Tunisia, in Ivory Coast, in just all over, that people have given me.
Wonderful. Okay, so we're going to move on to romance. Did you have any flirtations with the locals in any of the places?
Oh,
you
yes, indeedy, deedy, 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 deedy. Yes, indeed. My first, the first one was when I traveled in 75 when I went to Mozambique. And there was a group of expatriate Americans there. And I got involved with one of them in a brief romance, and to the point where he wanted to know if I would think about marrying him and all of that stuff. But he was actually living in Tanzania at the time, but he was not Tanzanian himself. So that doesn't count as being involved with, you know, one of the people who actually was Tanzanian. And that was that. And then when I went to Grenada in 82, I had a brief fling with one of the local people there, which was very exciting and very nice, and met him during Carnival. And that was, again, very brief because I was only there for a brief period of time. And then when I was in, I visited Tobago and Trinidad for the very first time in 77. This is when I went with my friend Loisy and had the most romantic relationship that you can imagine. This was with a man who was, he was a policeman, and he had just graduated from the academy, and my friend and I were standing out by the side of the road and waiting to flag a ride into town. And so I just thought that you could just flag down anybody. So I stepped out there and flagged down this car that was coming, and it was being driven by this fine young man. So we got in, and he took us to town. As it turned out, he was, you know, he's a police, but he was driving into town. And so we didn't know. We thought it was just a jitney, you know, that there were people that, you know, picked you up and took you where you wanted to go. But anyway, as it turned out, he was interested in me, and he came. And the lady who was the housekeeper, she prepared roti. I don't know if you know what roti is, but she prepared roti for us, which is made out of this flour dough. And then you fill it with, she filled it with curried goat. No, she filled it with curried crab, curried crab, and in those days I used to drink, and so we had a bottle of rum, and then when we got down to the beach where we were going, one person went up the tree and brought down some coconut water, so we had coconut water, rum, and our roti, and it was fabulous, and he was so sweet. I have a picture of him that I took with him, and he is just as fine. Oh my God! And we had a beautiful romance. I mean, just a beautiful romance. And he this is the one who left me a note. He came by the house to check to make sure I was okay, because I was in the house because my girlfriend had decided to go to Trinidad. She'd met somebody, and he had invited her to go to Trinidad. So I was in the house by myself. I had been earlier out with the children and friends of the housekeeper who was taking care of us while we were in Trinidad, but they had gone home. So I was in this huge house by myself. And he came around, he had come around earlier to check to see if we were okay, but we were out at the time. And then when he came back later on, I saw this flashlight outside, and he'd come around, and he had left this note for me, and he was saying that he'd come by to check on my dear self. It was just, I mean, just so sweet. Anyway, so that was a really wonderful romance that I had with him. Mm-hmm. And then, let's see. Well, in Ivory Coast, I was married, so that was not something, you know, that I would be involved in. And then in Cuba, no, because I was with a girlfriend, and we shared a room, and I was just having so much fun, just dancing and just really having a good time. And I met a couple of guys, but none of them, there was no chemistry, and so I was not, so that wasn't happening. But then I got here to Panama and fell in love with a man here in Panama. I met him in January, but it's finished because when I left in July, I had things that I truly needed to take care of with my family, with my finances, and with my daughter who was going to be leaving to go to France, and with a sibling retreat that my siblings and I do every year. And so I was planning to be gone for a couple of months, and we were still, he would call me from here, and I would call him from there, and we would email, and you know, and so it was, early September when I had to go to 5 different states while I was in the States, and it was certainly not a vacation. I just stuff that I had to do. And when I was in New York, there was this guy that I had met, the one that I told you about who owns this resort in Tobago. He's been interested in me, but I've never, I mean, at one point I was considering, you know, maybe something developing between us, but he was living in New York and I was in California, and we'd communicate by telephone and stuff like that. And so when I was in New York, I decided, let me just see if there's anything left, because if I don't want to have him thinking that he can come to Panama, because I truly, truly felt and still do feel very deeply for the man that I met here. So I let him know I was in New York, and I went to lunch with him. And my friend here in Panama, I had spoken with him by phone that Monday, and he said he was going to call me on Thursday. Well, I had the luncheon with him of this friend on Wednesday, and it really, really finalized and it just told me that there was absolutely nothing with this man in New York that I could build any kind of relationship on, and would never consider having him come to visit me here in Panama. And he knew it without my even putting in words, because when we went to a shop that was a man shop, he said, oh, you can buy something for your boyfriend here. And I hadn't really, you know, discussed anything about having a relationship here in Panama. So that Thursday, no call from my friend here in Panama. No call Friday, no call Sunday. So I called him on Monday. And he said, I thought you were going to call me. He says, oh, well, I was trying to get my registration for the car, and I had to get a new place. I said, you mean you couldn't find 5 minutes to call me during all that time? And so he couldn't really tell me anything. And so I said, I think you didn't call me because you thought that I was with somebody. Because he has that kind of mental telepathy with me. We've always been able to communicate with each other mentally. I mean, serious. I mean, it's serious. And I've tested it to make sure it's true, and it truly is. So I knew that he knew that I was with somebody in New York, but he didn't understand, and I tried to explain to him why I had gone to lunch to make sure that this man knew that there was no possibility of anything developing between us and that he could not come to Panama. Well, that was my mistake, and this was where I said, I always have to be aware of ego rearing its head. I never should have mentioned that to the friend here in Panama, because what I have learned since I've been here in Panama is that Panamanian men are very jealous, very very, very, very jealous. So when I came back to Panama, he did not meet me at the airport to pick me up. He did not accept any of my phone calls. He did not call me. He has kept himself away from me, completely away from me. And so I just sent him a text message, and I told him that this would be the last time that I would try to contact him, and that all I wanted was to send somebody to his home to pick up my keys, and he has the remote to the gate across my driveway. But this man absolutely showed me such sensuality and such deep, I mean, it is, I can't even describe it, but, and it was from the, when I first met him until the last time I saw him, that this intensity, has just, I mean, I don't know how to describe it. Mm. So that's been and I had not been involved. And when I started really thinking about it, Destiny, and this is all off the record, when I started thinking about it, I had never had such intensity in my life on a regular basis. I didn't have it in my marriage. I mean, the intensity on a regular basis, because I was seeing this man on average of every other day. Every other day. And I loved him. What drew me to him initially was his laugh and his sense of humor and his lightheartedness. I did not know that they concealed a depth of possessiveness that I did not know existed. And then I called him an Obia man, and he told me, he said, but you're the Obia woman. But we communicated by mental telepathy. I always knew when he was thinking of me, and he always knew when I was thinking of him, and that's how we communicated. And he would even send his spirit to me in my room. He would send his spirit to me when I was in my classroom trying to teach, trying to make love with me, and I had to ask him to stop because I could not focus. And so he stopped. He stopped doing it. But he was aware of what he was doing.
Wow. So this question is off the record, too. It's just my own curiosity. Do you think that there is ever any chance that you guys can reconnect? Because it seems that the connection was so strong that, you know, something so small shouldn't have caused so much disruption.
Well, first of all, he felt that I had left him for 2 months, that I didn't love him enough to only go for maybe 1 month, that I had left him for 2 months. And then when he felt that I was with another man, I think that he then felt that I had left him to go be with another man. And so that was the one thing that he cannot tolerate it. He cannot, because when we've had our differences before, it's usually been around what he's perceived as my not being forthcoming with him and keeping things from him. And, you know, let me give you an example of that. I'm in a house that is still under construction in a sense, and so I'm still having things done in the house. The owner is still having things done in the house. So this was in March, I think it was. I met him in January. This is March. And so I had someone here working in the house to hang a rod so that I could hang one of my Berber carpets that I brought back from Tunisia. And so when I got home from work that day, it was extremely hot. And so I came in my bedroom, and I closed the door, and I took my clothes off, and I was in my underwear, and I was up under the fan. Okay, I have a mosquito net over my bed. And so when I came in my room, I was going to just read and get in there. Well, I leaned against the net, and it pulled down from the ceiling. So I had to get up and put it back up there. And so when I put it back up, it was in a different place. It was still over my bed, but it was a little different from where it had been. So I'm in my room, and I hear these voices, and so I think at first that it's the workman talking on his cell phone. And then I hear this other voice that sounded kind of like my friend. And so I said, oh, well, whatever. But my door was closed. And so then the knock came on my door, and I opened it just enough to see who was there. And then when I saw it was him, I went and got my house coat, because I was in my bra and panties. And I went and got my house coat and put it on and went and opened the door so that he could come in. And so when he came in, he looked up at the mosquito net, and then he asked me why was I in my panties, in my underwear. And I said, because it was just so hot, and I was trying to get some relief. And so he just kept looking at me really strangely. So I had taken my house coat off once he came into the room and put it in the bathroom. So then I just went and put on one of my African dresses that's, you know, cotton and light. And he believed that I must have been doing something with the workman to be in my underwear and for the mosquito net to be in a different place. He never said a word about the mosquito net being in a different place. But when he looked up there, I knew exactly, because he notices everything. He doesn't miss anything, because this is how he was trained. He was trained to repair machines, and so whenever he would take apart anything, he always knew exactly in what order and where they were and all that. So he's been trained to observe everything down to the last detail, and this is just a part of who he is. So when he came in, even though the mosquito net was slightly off where it was, he noticed it. So he saw me in my underwear. The workman was in the other room, and my door was closed, and he could not understand why I was in my underwear with the workman in the house. And I couldn't understand why he would assume that I was doing something when this man has the key to my house and can come here at any time. Why would I engage in behavior so he left, and I did not hear from him for maybe 2 weeks.
Wow.
Because he was that convinced that I was involved in doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I kept thinking about it, I said, it doesn't make sense if this man has a key to my house, a key to the gate, can come and go at any time. I don't care if it's day, night, or whatever it is, knowing that I'm here. Why would he assume that I'm doing something with a man in my house working and my door is closed and I'm in my own bedroom. Mm-hmm. And then it occurred to me, that was exactly the point. It was irrational, and there was no way that you could make him understand that he wasn't making sense. He was not thinking. It was completely irrational, and all I needed to do was to leave it alone. I just stepped away from it, and I left it alone. Mm-hmm. I had to give him the space to just work it through however he needed to work it through and be done with it. This time, destiny is different. I've gotten the different signals, again, the intuition, again, all the stuff that I need to know, and it's just to kind of move on. This is what I got in my internet. I have this little internet astrology thing that comes to me every day. This came to me yesterday. It says, it's about, you know, why, what is the real reason that people break up? And it talks about the superficial kinds of stuff. But then it says, so let's bite down on the real reason you broke up so you can leave the stories behind and get through to some healing. The first, not meant to be. Yep, if you have to read it again, go for it. The universe wants us to find a great partner. We are attracted to the exact right person to learn the exact right thing at the exact right time. And sometimes that lesson comes to an end when we least expect it. But what it means is you're done here. You have learned what you were supposed to and hopefully had some great times going through the exercises. It's painful now, and the ego will wage war with accepting it. But this is the reason it has come to an end. And the second is, it's time to let them go. As soon as you can feel even a little bit of surrender, grab a hold of it and start the process of giving them back to the universe. A mantra can really help. As soon as they come to mind, say to yourself, Universe, I release this person to you and wish them health and happiness. You are returning the person back to where they came. It's like a Netflix list. You send one back, and a new one starts their journey to you. So just as soon as you can, tell the debate in your head to quiet down. You have a mantra to repeat so that you can let them go. And then finally, open your heart. You thought they were the one, but it turned out they were just the one for right now. Every relationship we have is a gift, so be grateful because another one is soon to arrive. You have to look ahead to what the universe is bringing you rather than look back at what you wish you had. So if you find yourself in a self-pity reflection pond, dry off and think about the good things you have in your life and have faith that if what you really want is a great relationship, that one is on its way to you. If you focus on what's coming, pretty soon it will arrive. Look, the pain of losing romantic love has launched ships, built sculptures, and created possibly every other pop song ever written. It's a big energy, and it's okay if it takes you over for a short time. And the pain will go through you if you let down your guard and walk right into it. It's not rejection, it's redirection. Surrender to the change and let the universe move you along to your, in your search for true love. This just came to me yesterday.
Mm. Wow.
So I text messaged him and just told him that this would be the last time that I would, you know, bother him, and that all I wanted was to send someone to pick up my keys, mm-hmm. and that I, you know, was really sorry that this was not the ending that I expected, but that's what it is. And so I'm really ready to move on, and I just give thanks and try not to lose sight of the fact that I have experienced a fantastic love affair. I truly have. I truly have. And so that was the lesson that I was supposed to get, because I had not experienced this kind of intensity of being with someone really almost every day. Not that we made love every day, but to be with that person and to have that kind of energy in my life was what I needed. It was really what I needed. And so now I'm strong enough, And I know that I'm attractive, because I, you know, people, almost no day goes by that somebody doesn't compliment me, and so I take that as positive and moving forward, and I am knowing that the man, my dream, the man that I dream of is on his way to me. I'm just positive about that, and it may be here in Panama. And maybe not, but I just know that this is where I'm supposed to be at this time in my life.
Mm.
Now, that one you can put on the record, that Panama is where I am supposed to be at this time in my life, and that a relationship with a Panamanian, either living here or coming back on a visit, is in the cards.
Oh, Okay. All right. Well, my next question, and of course you can, if you don't want this to be on the record either, just let me know. But it seems obvious with your most recent relationship that you certainly had this degree of intensity that you hadn't felt before. But in your travels abroad, do you have those experiences where you feel more beautiful, more sensuous?
Oh, absolutely, honey. Anything outside of California. In California, darling, you are looked through by black men in California. And this is not just my experience. What I'm relating to you is what my girlfriends experience. And I'm not just talking about women of my generation, but women of my daughter's generation, not my youngest one, but women who are in their 40s and 50s and 60s, and even in their 30s. They don't feel appreciated by the men in California who are looking for the ones who look most white or whatever. It's just, I don't know if it's because of the Hollywood, the nearness, the proximity to Hollywood, or in that entertainment industry that's in Southern California, movies and music. But, honey, you have to move outside of California, and really almost outside of the States, although I have not been ignored when I've been on the East Coast. In fact, I attract a lot of attention in the South, in the East. I've attracted a lot of attention here in Panama, both from the Afro-Antiano Panamanians and the ones of Latino descent. And there has to be chemistry. There has to absolutely be chemistry. And with this man that I met, I had been here 6 months, and I had been kind of approached in roundabout ways from different men, here in Panama. But this one, the chemistry was there from the moment we met. The chemistry was there. Hmm. So, yes, you do experience, and this, again, comes from many of the women that I know who travel. You do experience this when you go abroad. You just have to be alert to whether or not the attraction that you generate is genuine or if it's somebody on a hustle. And you you get to a point where you can tell if somebody is genuinely interested in you or as a person, or genuinely interested in you as a meal ticket. You learn very quickly how to distinguish between the two.
Mm. So why?
And I think that what I also understand is that white women realize that when they go abroad, they are the object of attention of many black men or men of color, and usually it's because these men see them as meal tickets.
Mm. So why do you think it's the case that that you felt more sensual? Do you think it's a sort of a greater cultural acceptance of an African American woman? Like, why do you think that that men are so much more open than, say, in California?
You see yourself reflected in the women of that particular culture that you are now a part of, and they're very proud of who they are, and they're very And the features that are considered a disadvantage in the States are considered an advantage when you go abroad, because that's how everybody looks. I mean, that's considered beautiful. I mean, I've come here and I guess you could call my skin color light skin. I'm not high yellow or any of that, but I guess you'd consider me maybe a red bone if anything. But I don't know, and my hair, as I said before, I wear it in my natural state most of the time with twists, and sometimes I just pull it all up on top of my head, but it's still in its natural state, and sometimes I just wear whatever occurs to me. But I certainly still have the big lips. I still have the nose that is not narrow. I still have eyes that they call shiny eyes, I think a lot of it, Destiny, has to do with that I am absolutely comfortable in my skin. And the only thing that I have to sometimes stop and admonish myself about is the aging process. nobody believes me when I tell them my age. They think that I'm in my late 40s or early 50s, and I'm 2 years away from being 70 years old. But nobody believes me, so I just stop telling them. I just don't even say anything anymore. Because I do all the things, that this is why I consider myself so blessed. Because I dance, I walk, I do all the things. I take care of my own house. If it's a good party, girl, I'll party all night until they turn the lights off and send us out. But I am healthy. I come from peasant stock, and so I don't have arthritis. I don't have rheumatism. I don't have any of those things.
So have you ever seen the movie How Stella Got Her Groove Back? And if so, do you identify with her as a character, or do you feel that you are different?
No. Terry McMillan, I met her a long, long time ago when she came to this group that I belong to in San Francisco, because I've always associated with writers and artists and musicians and people like that, because these are the people that I really love being around. And she came before our group, so we kind of knew her before she hit the big time. And her first two works, Mama, the one that she first wrote, I liked, and then the next one was okay. But after that, I just felt that she was writing sophisticated soap opera, and I just was not into that. So I don't identify at all with How Stella Got Her Groove Back. I really don't, because men seem to be attracted to me ranging in age from their 50s all the way through their 80s. And so I just take it in stride.
Okay.
In fact, some are even in their 40s, but I just take it in stride. If the chemistry is not there, I don't bother. And I've come around to the position that once you are an adult, you are an adult. And if you find someone that you can be with comfortably, no matter what the age is, whether that person is years older than you or you're years older than that person, what the hell? If you can get along and enjoy yourselves together, you're both adults, then what's the big deal?
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like, I know I asked you about perceptions of African Americans abroad, but with the men in particular, do you think they have very specific perceptions about African American women? And if so, what are they?
I don't really know. You know, I haven't had a chance to actually sit down with men from the various let me go back. There was one occasion when I was still living in Abidjan and I was teaching an adult class, and one of my students was African. And we got onto this whole thing about what is attractive in women and why men choose the kind of women that they do. Because I have a real problem with light-skinned women being chosen over dark-skinned women. I just have a problem with that. Even though I'm a light-skinned woman, I just get very pissed when I see black men who want to choose light-skinned, long-haired women looking white over their dark-skinned sisters. And so we were having a conversation, and I was asking him about that. And he was saying, well, they'd like to choose the light-skinned ones because they bring light into the house. They bring light into the house, whereas with the dark ones, they're not happy and blah, 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 blah. So that was the first time that I actually asked somebody just up front, why would you choose a light-skinned woman over a dark-skinned woman? And that was his answer. I've seen it before that men outside of the United States, whether they're from Africa or the Caribbean, somehow if they themselves are dark-skinned, they tend to want to choose light-skinned women. And I've seen the opposite happen, whereas light-skinned men, particularly from the Caribbean, seem to prefer dark-skinned women. And so I don't know, maybe it's just that opposites attract. And then for men from the Caribbean and from Africa who seem to want to prefer African-American women to their women where they're from, it may be that they see African-American women as more open, as more educated, as more lenient in terms of cultural norms. I mean, I don't know. You could come up with dozens of reasons as to why there seems this preference on the part of many men in the diaspora for African American women. I don't know. I really don't. It's pure speculation.
Mm-hmm. So, in terms of travel, did you feel like people in the places that you traveled to had sort of preconceived notions about your reasons for travel? Did they sort of see you as sort of coming on a tourist thing, or do you see what I mean? Like, what were their assumptions about the reasons for your visiting their countries?
Unless you were traveling by yourself or with a girlfriend, the normal perception was that you were a tourist coming in to see the country and coming in to just get a taste of what the country was like, the culture and everything else. If you were traveling either alone or as part of maybe a girlfriend with another girlfriend, then there could be a perception that you were coming there for romance.
So,
but generally, when I've traveled, it's not been for going on a vacation. It's usually been for a purpose. And for example, when I was traveling to and living in Tunisia, it was because I was going to be working there. When I went to China, it was because I was going to be tutoring a group traveling there for a festival. When I went to Brazil, it was for a spiritual journey. And when I went the first time to Mozambique, and was in Tanzania for a while, even though I had a romance there, again, a part of what I wanted to do was to realize a lifelong dream of visiting Africa and being there for Mozambique's independence after years of struggle to be free from Portuguese rule. So my reasons for traveling have not been going and seeking romance. If it happened while I was there, now the only time that might have been the case was when I went with my girlfriend Loisy to Tobago and Trinidad. But again, it was to visit a place where we knew someone, and that my intention certainly was not to go there to have a romance. It just happened that I met somebody that developed into that, but it was not to go there to have a romance. And what I can tell from his perception was that we weren't there looking for romance.
So this next series of questions are specifically about Panama. You told me that your reasons for, moving to Panama, but what did you think about the country before your first visit there?
About Panama?
Mm-hmm.
I had always wanted to visit Panama. I don't know why, what it was that attracted me to Panama, but I just wanted to visit Panama because the notion of black Panamanians and I don't know if I'd met somebody from Panama. I may have met somebody from Panama. I may have had a professor who was married to a Panamanian. And I don't know if that may have triggered an interest, but I can't really tell you specifically why I had always wanted to visit here. I do know that when I came here, I didn't like it. And I was planning on leaving Panama after I completed the first year of my teaching contract, which was a two-year contract, because I was so disillusioned by what I found here in Panama. I hated the school. I mean, I hated the environment at the school where I worked because it was just awful. It was absolutely the worst experience that I've had in my teaching career. And I decided that was not where I wanted to be. But that did eventually turn around because I was eventually able to show the parents and the teachers that I absolutely had command of my subject and mastery of it. And there was this resistance when I came in because the teacher that I replaced had left the class in a shambles. I mean, truly, those kids were not prepared for the rigor of the program. And this is what I was accustomed to, was applying the rigor, to this program. Because if they were going to succeed, they had to be able to achieve when they set for the exams. And all of the courses were, all of the syllabus was prepared for them to do that. So I was able to turn that situation around. But by the time that happened, which was in December, I had already made up my mind that I was not going to stay at the school and that I was planning on leaving Panama in June. And then when I met my friend in January, I embarked on this love affair with him with the idea that I was going to be leaving in June. So I was just planning on having a short fling with this guy. I wasn't planning on anything permanent. And I decided that I would just be here, and that was our understanding, is that he would be a lover for the time that I would be here in Panama in June. Things changed. We fell in love with each other, which was not planned. The job that I was intending to take in the States in June when leaving Panama fell through, as did the condo that I had leased and had put down a deposit on fell through. And so I had to regroup, and what I decided to do was to take a year off and decide where I wanted to live, with whom I wanted to be, and what I wanted to be doing for the foreseeable future. And that's why I'm still here in Panama. Mm-hmm. And I've decided that I am going to buy a place to live. I'm looking for something in the Portobello side because I like that side of Panama better than I do the Pacific side of Panama. I like the Afro-Antiano presence here in Panama, and this is where I want to focus my attention. I really do want to know more about the Afro-Antiano presence here in Panama. The people that I deal with on a daily basis are all Afro-Antianos. And so this is where I've decided that I want to make my home for the next few, for the foreseeable future.
Mm. So I know you mentioned that you didn't like Panama when you first got there, but how would you characterize the experience overall now that you've decided to stay? Has it been a positive experience?
I've learned that I can live here. I've learned that I can absolutely live here. I don't know if I could live here if I had to work, but I can certainly live here without working. And I think a major part of my unhappiness in being here in Panama initially was the traffic. I absolutely could not deal with it. I had to do it, but I have never, ever become accustomed to the traffic. Absolutely have not become accustomed to it. I can deal with it. I drive and I do what I do. I've become like a Panamanian in the way I drive, and I get out there and I do what the Panamanians do, but it is not an enjoyable experience. Mm-hmm. The neighborhood where I'm living right now is not where I want to continue to live. I like the ambiance here. I really like the way the people are here, but I don't like the neighborhood where I'm living because it's dangerous. There was a shooting across the street from me in early July. 4 people were shot. 1 of them seriously ended up staying in the hospital. 3 were released after that. And the neighbors across the street are very loud, and they're just not considerate of everybody else. Mm. It trashes all over the place. They don't have, it seems, regular pickup of the trash, and so it just ends up being all over the place. I don't like the fact that the markets here are owned by the Chinese. I don't see any Afro-Antianos in particular owning the little local stores, and that disturbs me a great deal. But I love having access to coconut water whenever I want it. I love being able to walk up there and get fresh fruits. I love having a man who sells fresh fish come to my door and I can select what I want at a really good price. I love being able to go to the beach when I want to, you know, to go to Playa Bonita or to go to Coronado or to go to Gorgona where I have friends. So I like all of those things, but what annoys me is that the black Panamanians here don't seem to have a really good toehold in the decision-making policies that take place here. I mean, I just don't see it. Maybe it's because I don't speak Spanish, and so I'm not able to really understand the dynamics of the governing here, but I don't see black folks in positions of prominence here. I don't see them in the stores. I don't see them in the government agencies. And I don't see them in the advertising that you see. If you were not living here in Panama and knew black Panamanians, you wouldn't know that there were any in here if you only looked at the advertisements, whether it's on TV or on the billboards or whatever. It's just that everything here seems to be geared towards being as European as possible. And that bothers me.
So how would you compare life to Panama to life in the U.S.?
I'm here because I like being here better than I like being in the U.S. right now.
Wow.
At this stage in my life, where I am, in a sense, savoring the fruits of my labor. This is where I want to be now. I don't want to be right here in this neighborhood where I am, and I'm looking for something that is more pleasing to my spirit. And I love water, and I want to be near water, so this is why I'm looking in Portobello to see if I can find a place there. But I prefer being in Panama now to being in the U.S. I like the ambience here in Panama overall. I like the way that people are willing to help you, that people are willing to connect to you, that there is a human element here that is basically missing in the United States. People in the United States do not appear to be happy when you go to public places. And depending, I mean, and this is what I'm saying, where you have the mix of everybody. When you're in black neighborhoods, it's not like that. Because when I'm in the States, I'm usually in Atlanta, and I love being in Atlanta. I love where my friend lives, where there are trees and lawns, and you can, and the people in the, you just get a feeling of connection, of being a part of a community. I have that feeling when I go to my friend in Oakland, where she lives. So again, you have little pockets in the United States where you can have this feeling of connection and being a part of a community, and where people are basically happy with their lives and not frustrated and all of that. And here in Panama, I find that overall people appear to be happy with their lives because they have their families and they have their friends. Yes, it's hard here. Yes, the majority of people here are poor. But there seems to be still a spirit that despite being poor, they can still have a sense of happiness and of joy. And that is what I like by being here.
So how would you characterize your experience as a U.S. citizen of African descent in Panama? Do you think it's different from white Americans who live there or not?
No, as far as white Americans, I can't answer that question because I don't know what their experience is here, except in a secondhand way by some of my colleagues that I used to work with at the school. There was one who was extremely unhappy with the school primarily, but Panama itself, I don't think they. I think that with most white Americans who come to Panama, they come here as retirees. Very few of them, as far as I know, come here to work in the Panamanian government or whatever it is. But from what I've seen, most of them come here as expatriates who are retiring. So their experiences of being around ordinary Panamanians, I don't know what that is. For myself, I have just immersed myself into life here in Panama. I have a Panamanian woman of Latina descent who does my massage for me. She is married to he looks like he's Afro-Antiano. She's shown me his picture, and we had she speaks Spanish and I speak English, so we communicate the best we can, but she let me know last week that she likes black men, you know. And the neighbors up and down the street are a mix of Latin and Afro-Antiano. The ones straight across the street from me that I told you about, they are—they look like the grandmother is Latina, and the children look like they are a mix of Latina and African. So you know, it's hard to just tell how people are. The African Americans that I know who have settled here in Panama love it. They absolutely adore being here in Panama. Carolyn lives in Obarrio, and she loves it. The other friend lives in La Chorrera, and she has a house out there that she bought and that she's modified and remodeled. She loves it. Another friend who is actually Jamaican but who married an African-American, and lived in the States, she retired, and she moved here to Panama, and she loves it. She also lives out in La Chorrera. I have another pair of friends. They are African-American. They moved here from Arizona. They retired. They are dentists, and they retired. They have bought property here. They own at least 10 or 12 properties that they have bought and that they are landlords, and they love it here. And her mother and father have bought one of the properties from the daughter and out in El Paraiso, and they have a house out there that they come here and spend part of the year there, and then they spend part of the time in the States because I think the mother is still working. So those are African Americans that love being here in Panama. Mm-hmm. And then there's another couple that lives about a three-hour drive from here in the hills, in the foothills of Panama. They love it. They retired, and they used to live in Washington, D.C. There's another couple that I have met. They live in near Gorgona, and they also have a house over near Balboa. And they love being here in Panama. So everyone that I know who has come here to Panama loves being here, and they came here basically to retire. Mine is the only, I'm the only one of the group who was working, who came here to work. And my experience necessarily has been different from theirs. Mm-hmm. But now that I'm not working, my experience more parallels theirs, even though I did not retire with a pension and all of that stuff. You know, I was able to retire because I sold my house. Mm-hmm. But overall, I am still adjusting to life here in Panama. Obviously, it was much, 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 much more pleasant and happy for me when I had a lover. But now that I'm having to readjust, I'm still looking forward to enjoying life here in Panama. And now I have the time to really look for where I want to live and to be with whom I want to be and to do the work that I want to do, which will probably be involve some form of teaching either online or doing something along doing radio commercials or voiceovers for TV. So this is what I'm aiming at right now.
Okay, great. So do Panamanians like easily recognize you as an American, or do you have to speak first before they recognize?
No, they think that I'm Panamanian. They're not sure, and so they speak to me in Spanish, and so when I speak in English, then they see that I'm not West Indian, because sometimes they think that I might be West Indian, and sometimes Panamanian. But when I speak, because of my accent, they know that I'm not Panamanian and that I'm not West Indian. I'm not Afro-Antiano.
Okay. So I have a few final questions just about immigration to the U.S. Did you interact with immigrants when you were living in the U.S.? I know you said there weren't many when you were growing up. Okay.
I was married to one.
Oh, yes, the from the Ivory Coast.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so were your interactions with immigrants sort of centered around that setting, sort of being married to an immigrant, or did you encounter them in other capacities, like at work or at school or teaching them or whatever?
Both, in all categories. I knew immigrant families before I actually met and married the man that was from Africa. So I had interactions with all of them. As I said, my best friend was from Nigeria, and she and her brother had immigrated to the States, and we went to college together, and we became friends, and we remained friends until she died. I had other immigrant friends who were from the islands, from Jamaica in particular, from Honduras, from Belize, and from all these other places, and I guess I have an empathetic nature, because I just empathize. I just want to, when I see people, I don't know, it's, I guess from growing up as a child, I've always connected with people who are having a hard time, and I just don't want to see them have a hard time, and I want to be able to do whatever I can to help them. And when you see the immigrant families that come to the United States and how hard they work to try to become a part of the American community and how difficult it is, and I'm telling you, these are some hardworking folks that work 2-3 jobs, that come with an education but cannot get a job that allows them to use their education because they don't have, you know, the right papers or whatever it is that they need to have. You just have this empathy. And so this was my experience with immigrant friends and families. I just understood what they were going through.
So what other qualities do you generally associate with certain groups? For example, Latino immigrants, African immigrants, and Caribbean immigrants?
I've seen every last one of them work as hard as they could to lift themselves up and to make life better for their families. I've never seen any of them come to the States and lie down and expect somebody to take care of them. That has not been my experience. It has not been my experience. I mean, they have come to the States and they've tried to keep their families intact. They work hard and they usually have to live in communities where there's a lot of crime, where there's a lot of poverty, where there's just a lot of all of the things that can work together to just break your spirit. And for the most part, they've been able to resist this, but I do know of cases where some of them have lost their children to drugs, some of them have lost their children to gangs. But for the most part, they keep themselves and their families intact by working very, very, very hard. But it's an extremely difficult task, because how are you going to be working two or three jobs? Who's going to be looking after your children? I've seen this firsthand, Destiny, and it breaks your heart when you see it happen. It happened to one of the dear friends that I had through my husband. It was just heartbreaking to see the kid get caught up in drugs and end up in jail. And it just breaks your absolute heart to see the father loving this son and trying to bring him up along with his brother and his sister. The father was able to come to the States. He had the papers to come, but the mother didn't have her papers, and so they kept her in France. And so the father came to the States trying to keep his family together, and it was the most horrendous, most heartbreaking thing you could imagine.
So
I have not yet encountered an immigrant family not willing to make every sacrifice possible to make life better for their children.
Wow. So how do members of your family perceive immigrants? Do they share your appreciation?
No, they do not. They don't share to the extent that I do, but I have been able to, over the years, influence the way they look at people from the West Indies or from Africa and places like that. I have absolutely played a positive role in their change of attitudes, because like anybody, they were suspicious of people who were not like them. And they had these stereotypical views of people, you know, that West Indians are stingy, that they are clannish, and that, you know, the Africans are you know, not as well educated. Just all the crap, all the BS that you hear. African Americans entertain those same kinds of ideas about people that they are cousins to and that have common ancestors. And it's not until they are exposed to different ways of life that they can begin to change their minds. And they feel the same way towards Mexicans. It's towards the Chinese, towards the Japanese, towards the Koreans. There's a lot of racial tension and animosity in the United States between the various groups, among the various groups, from African Americans who have been there the longest, who did not voluntarily migrate to the United States, who were brought there as slaves and who've been there the longest. Many of them are very resentful about what they see as the preferential treatment of people who have come as immigrants, who have voluntarily come there as immigrants. Many African Americans can't stand that, and they don't like it, whether these immigrants are from Indochina or from Africa or from the Caribbean. They don't like it, because they feel that they have been bypassed, that they have been overlooked, and that they have been there, that they truly are Americans, yet are denied the benefits of being American citizens in favor of these new, what they see as newcomers. It's a complex relationship.
So do you, it seems like the people you describe are resentful of immigrants because of sort of a fear of their taking up resources that could be used by African Americans themselves. Do you worry about?
Yes.
Oh, go ahead.
And you know what? And you know, the tragedy is that African Americans are just like the Americans of European descent in their suspicion of the immigrants coming in and taking jobs. And the tragedy is that African Americans themselves are the products of that same racism and xenophobia. Mm-hmm. And here they are practicing what has been done to them.
Mm-hmm.
And what was done to them was that these African Americans, after the first generation of Africans brought to the U.S., are native-born Americans, yet have never been treated as native-born Americans, but as immigrants. And so when you see this dynamic of being on the receiving end of the racism and the xenophobia and all of this kind of stuff, and then turning around and using that same thing against the newcomers, it's such a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
It is such a tragedy.
I agree.
Sometimes the immigrants coming in exhibit behavior that makes them that is perceived as being superior to the African Americans who are there. Many of the immigrants come in with the belief, from what they've either been told or seen, that African Americans are nothing but criminals, drug dealers, drug addicts, dysfunctional families with single women heading their households. And so they come in with this feeling that these are the traits that you will find in African Americans. So on both sides, there are these stereotypes and misconceptions and misunderstandings that tend to taint the relationships between African Americans and others of African heritage. It's just, you know, it's just there.
So do you worry about the possibility of too much immigration? It doesn't seem to me that you do, but
No, I don't.
Right.
I don't.
Right.
So, I don't. Because what, and I laugh about it sometimes, even though it really isn't that funny, is that these Americans, but primarily Europeans, that went into these countries, whether in Latin America or in Asia or in Africa, and plundered and stole everything out of those countries that they could, and imposed a European view of superiority in these places where they went, took everything out of there that they could, and then fled back to their countries, not understanding that the people that they had robbed were going to follow them at some point. And that is what has happened, that these people whose countries they went into and colonized, now these generations later are moving into Europe, moving to North America, moving into Latin America, moving all over the globe, and they're having a fit and trying to throw up these walls and trying to keep these people out. They're not going to be able to keep them out.
I agree.
And so I just find it terribly ironic. And again, if you had any kind of sense of humor or irony, you would find it funny, but it's not, because it's creating all of these tensions in these European countries and in North America, where these old European societies, where the average age, you know, these are elderly societies, aging societies, because their birth rates cannot keep up with what's happening in the developing world. And they are confronted now with a workforce that it has to be recruited, really, these immigrants who come in to do the work that they no longer have the population to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I just say, serves them right.
I agree. So are there particular immigration laws or policies that come to mind when you think of immigration to the U.S.?
Well, you go back to the one, the exclusion laws that kept the Asians out of the United States, and there have just been laws. If you go back, I can't cite any ones in particular, but that was the one that I do remember that restricted immigration from Asia, from China in particular, the exclusion laws. And so to keep the Asians out, and then this whole thing that's happening around immigration now in the United States, where they don't even talk about it anymore. It's such an emotional issue, they don't even talk about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But it was designed to give people who had been in the United States illegally for at least a certain number of years to apply for amnesty and then to eventually become citizens after undergoing whatever courses or tests or whatever it was that they were designing. and because of political fallout and because of the far right wing of the government, that they had to put that aside. And this is, and you know, it serves them right. It's because a lot of Hispanics that have migrated to the United States, whether they come from Central America or from Cuba or from wherever they come from, they embrace the Republican Party's philosophy because it involves wealth and all that kind of stuff. And what they don't understand and what black people have always understood is that the Republican Party primarily, even though you find some of it in the Democrats, the Republican Party finds itself to be exclusive, and it's only involved with property and wealth. And so when these people first come to the United States, they just love the principles of the Republican Party. And so a lot of them became Republicans, especially in Miami with the Cubans that came out of Castro's Cuba. And then you'll find it in California and in New Mexico and Arizona, all the countries that border Mexico. They come in and they become these Republicans. They want to become property owners and they want to have businesses and all this stuff. Well, their minds and their eyes were open to the real truth, because when they had this firestorm around immigration and to keep out and to kick out all of these so-called illegal aliens, then they understood that these Latin Americans, that these Spanish-speaking folks were the target of the racism by these Republicans, these right-wing Republicans, building a wall along the border between Arizona and Mexico to keep out these people. I mean, I'm telling you, so they saw for themselves, because initially you had all these people going for McCain, 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 McCain. Honey, who do you think they support now? Because McCain backed up on the immigration, because at first he was supporting George Bush's, you know, limited amnesty and allowing people to, you know, deserve to apply for citizenship. Honey, that's gone down the tubes, because when they understood what was happening, they would go into a business and they would find the owner and see these businesses were employing these people at dirt cheap rates. And so when they determined that they were going to close down these businesses that hired these so-called illegal aliens and they deport them, they changed the law so that instead of these people being just deported, you know, after it was found that they didn't have their papers, they would send them to prison for 5 months, separate the women from the children, the women from the husbands, hold them in prison for 5 months, and then deport them. That's how punitive the law became. Mm-hmm. And that's what's been kept very quiet.
Mm.
So it used to be that they would simply be deported. Now they put them in prison for 5 months and then deport them.
Mm. So what do you think U.S. power
shapes? Just mean-spirited.
Right. I agree. Well, what do you think the policy should be on immigration in the U.S.?
It should be like everywhere else. It should be like everywhere else. For example, here in Panama, I can come here on a tourist visa, and then I can apply for any number of classes of visa to allow me to stay here.
Hmm.
In the United States, they have the different classes of visa. You can get a tourist visa. You can get a student visa. You can get they have special visas that allow primarily people in the technology industry to come in from India on a special visa that allows them to come and live in the United States and work, right? But what happens that is the application of these laws. Destiny, when it's somebody coming in from Latin America or from Africa, it is extremely difficult to get a visitor's visa, extremely difficult. Because they feel that these people will stay here once their visa is over. I mean, stay in the States. I think I'm in the States. They think that they're going to stay. So they won't give them a visitor's visa, a tourist visa. They won't give it to them. See, it's not like here in Panama where you just come and when you get to the airport, you pay for a visa and that allows you to stay here for 3 months, right? In the States, you cannot even set foot on the property until you have a visa in your passport.
Mm.
And it usually costs you $100 to apply for a visa. And if they don't give you a visa, you've simply lost $100. How many people here in Panama can afford to lose $100?
That's true.
So in terms of whatever the laws are in the United States, I do not see them amending them or fixing them or whatever, because they want to keep out people of color from the United States.
Are you optimistic about the immigration policies of the new president, depending on who's
I don't know whether they will be his policies, but what I do know is that with a new Congress that will be Democratic, I believe that they will at least address the issue and listen to the voices of the constituencies. That's what I'm thinking will happen. Mm-hmm. Instead of having a closed mind that only listens to business interests and to the right-wing ideologues, I think that they will open up a discussion that will be beneficial to everyone.
Okay. Good. All right. So my last few questions are just about community involvement. Are you still involved with any community groups or organizations back in California?
Not really. I've really cut all of my ties to California, because when I sold my house, it was with the intention of never moving back to California, never to live in California again, because I never felt that California was home for me. So when I sold my house, it was goodbye to California. I only go there when I'm meeting my siblings and these dear friends of mine who still live there. But other than that, mm-mm. And since I've come here to Panama, I've joined the American Society of Panama, and I'm truly happy to be involved in this oral history project with the voices from our America. I'm really looking forward to being more active with that. And as far as, you know, because I hadn't lived in the States, you know, since 2004, but when I lived in Tunisia, I was in with the Lions Club over there, and so I will probably join the Lions Club here in Panama once I get settled. Everything depends on my getting settled in whatever area I intend to live in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a member of really any groups in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you said the Alliance Club. What is that?
The Alliance Club, it's an organization that's worldwide, and they involve themselves in bettering the lives of the communities in which they find themselves. We take on projects like providing educational opportunities for educational support for young people who ordinarily wouldn't have a chance to do that. We do cleanup projects. We get involved with orphanages and senior citizens places and try to provide services for them there on a voluntary basis. And so the Lions Club, it's a volunteer organization that's worldwide and that really does try to help the people of a community who need a little bit of support, and this is generally in the areas of education, of providing cultural opportunities for the kids, like after school tutoring and music and art and things like that.
So you mentioned I know you talked throughout this interview about your passion for education and also your passion for children. What specific messages would you like to communicate to younger generations, you know, just about the world beyond the U.S. and about your own experiences?
They have to see themselves as citizens of the world. They have to see themselves as connected to every living entity on the planet. They have to see themselves whenever they might feel separation or anything else. It's something that I read a long time ago, is that what connects us is our heartbeat. Every living thing has a heartbeat, and so when we realize that we all have a heartbeat and that's what connects us, it's the string that connects us, then we never feel that we are separate from others and that this separation is a good thing, and it's not. And we really do have to see ourselves as citizens of this entire planet, and that we have the obligation and the responsibility and the privilege to take care of each other by seeing each other as ourselves, you know, and that there can be no them and us. We really have to see ourselves as citizens of the world with the ability and with the courage and with the love to make sure that this is a planet that we can all live on and take care of and enjoy. And just, you know, every morning when I do my meditation, I always bless everybody in the world with love, peace, joy, and abundance. The entire planet, I bless everything, the birds, the animals, the air itself, the sunshine, and the people. And I just do this because that is what we are called to do. We are called to be each other's blessers. We really are. And so when we are working with young people, we have to give them the idea that they matter to us, that they are of value to us. And I remember the first year when I was living in Abidjan that I taught at the school, and we went to this conference. And this guy, Dr. Ron Marino, I will never forget what he said. He said that when you are working with young people, you must always remember that they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And so I always want the young people that I work with to understand how much I care for them, and that when we share the learning experience, it's one of reciprocity, and that everything that we learn is about them, that there is nothing that we pick up and look at in a book that is not about them, and that when they come into the classroom, they are not empty vessels waiting to be filled up, that they come in and that their experiences are as valid as anything we will examine. And so once we understand that, then we're okay.
That's so true. So what do you think it would take to get African-American youth interested in the world beyond the U.S.? I know you mentioned education, opportunities, but are there any other things that you think would help?
With the Internet, it's already happening. Mm-hmm. With the Internet, it's already happening. And that's why I love that thing about www. And sometimes we forget that it means World Wide Web. And so here we are, that we're able to communicate with people all around the world. And this is happening in classrooms where there are African-American children. And they are becoming involved. And they can do it through science projects where they can be connected directly with what the animal life is like in Africa or in the Caribbean or in South America or any of these places. So, again, it is happening, Destiny. It's happening on a small scale right now, but it is blossoming. And I think that with the election of Barack Obama, it's going to open up the world to African-American children.
Mm. I agree. Are you still, I'm not sure what the policy is about U.S. citizens living abroad, but do you still have the right to vote, and will you be voting in the upcoming
election?
Oh,
yes, absolutely. Honey, I've already voted.
Oh, really? That's great.
Oh, yes, honey. Okay. I sent my ballot in, you know, because this one, I would never miss it for anything in the world, not for anything in the world. This is something that I'm sharing with my children and with my grandchildren, and that it will be passed on from generation to generation, that we were instrumental in electing the first African-American to be president of the United States. Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. One of the things that that I'm really thankful for, whatever the outcome of the election is that I was watching World News Tonight yesterday, and they were talking about how many African-Americans have now registered to vote because of the upcoming election.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And you saw where the Supreme Court struck down this challenge by this Ohio, the state of Ohio, to challenge these voters. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was so glad, because they're doing everything they can to keep people from registering to vote and voting. But, you know, it's just, oh, man, I tell you. it's just so wonderful to see. It's just so wonderful to be a part of it. I am so happy with it.
Mm.
But yes, okay. life is absolutely the most wonderful experience that one can have. I mean, it truly is, when you understand that you can live life fearlessly. Because when you understand what's really important in your life, you can go about living it and not being afraid of anything.
Mm. That's true. Well, I'm actually down to my last question, and it's just a general one. Is there anything else you would like to share with us that we haven't touched on in the interview?
Let, While we were talking, I went to try to find the thing that I was trying to describe to you when you were asking me in the first part of it. And if I have a minute, I'll just read it to you. It's not that long. It's I entitled it Passion's Fruits. And I this was when I was finishing up the last credits for my CLEAR credential, and I had to do this for a teaching reading in secondary school. But I entitled it Passion's Fruits. Mm. I am a passionate woman. Blues from the Mississippi Delta, Cuban son, and Congolese Kwasa Kwasa transport me into a world of pounding, pulsating rhythms that command my feet to move and my body to sway. I feel the music in my soul. It is in the touch of my partner's hand on my waist, turning me, pulling me close, his minty breath blowing air into my ear, his velvet eyes looking into my own to witness the pleasure that dancing in his arms brings. As the night advances, sweat transforms all of us into swimmers on dry land. As I dance, a breeze from the sea comes bringing the smell of bougainvillea, hibiscus, and jasmine. Suddenly, I am back in Africa in a ruthless dance hall, looking up at the stars, winking their joy at the sight of us, twirling, spinning, swaying, and moving to rhythms they recognize from the dawn of time. The insistent surf bumps up against the rocks that protect the little dance hall. The tides, shh, shh, between the drum beats is a counterpoint to the keka keka of the shekere. I am pulled back to the present when the musicians take a break and the music ends. Music is not my only passion. I love literature. It doesn't matter if it's a novel by Toni Morrison or Sandra Cisneros, a poem by Langston Hughes or Pablo Neruda, a play by Sophocles or August Wilson, a short story by Kate Chopin or Opal Palma Adisa, an essay by Alice Walker or Ralph Waldo Emerson. Morrison's Beloved sends chills down my spine when I feel Setha's knife against her baby's throat because she's decided to take back the life she's given rather than see her girl child a slave and pray to any depraved white man who takes a fancy to her. In Sophocles' tragedies, I taste the bitterness of inevitability. The gods play with humans whose own tragic flaws seal their doom. Despite all their efforts to avoid catastrophe, they cannot escape their fate. On the other hand, an essay by Emerson lifts my spirits because of the absolute belief that we are masters of our fate and that we are all connected to the great and loving Oversoul. We transcend our human condition, which often feels lonely, when we nod back at the plants that nod to us in greeting, caress the bark of a tree, rub a smooth rock, and taste a melting snowflake in recognition of our unity with all living things. We transcend our human condition by accepting others as ourselves. We go beyond the surface to communicate soul to soul. Even when we are most fearful, we must reach out in compassion and love to others. On occasion, I have been able to overcome my own fears in reaching out. It's usually been when a child has been mistreated. I am passionate about the well-being of children. My tongue comes unglued, my adrenaline rushes to my brain, my body grows 10 feet tall, and I act. Once at New York's Penn Station, I yelled across the crowded lobby at a young, impatient mother to stop pulling her daughter's hair. Heaven knows what would have happened if I'd been within striking distance. Other times, it's been as simple as writing a letter to elected officials to increase or provide funding for school books, hot lunches, street lighting in neglected neighborhoods, or jobs for the children's parents. A direct confrontation with adults who are slapping, hitting, pinching, or cussing their children is not something that I seek, but I can't stand to see children abused. I love to touch the shoulder or pat the back of the students I work with. In that light touch, I try to convey the affection I feel for them and to let them know that someone cares about them. I am passionate about good food. Grilled salmon, marinated in yogurt and tandoori sauce, turns me into a glutton. All fruit is the object of my affection. I especially like the fruits of summer. How can I describe the taste of a plum? I can't. But its texture is like the grosgrain ribbon. It has to be firm. I hate mushy fruit. And it doesn't matter if it's a red, black, or green plum. Apricots have to have a tangy taste, just on the verge of being ripe. Its color looks as if the apricot is blushing. Watermelon. To find and select a perfectly sweet watermelon is an art that I'm still perfecting. I've almost come to believe that I have to go to the field to pick one from the vine myself It seems as if they're being plucked before they're ripe to suit financial interest in shipping them to ripen as they ride, but that's not possible. A hot summer day, the sun taps my skull, unprotected by lots of hair or a hat, barefoot. Dirt squeezes between my toes as I search rows of oblong globes of green with a little yellowish beige here and there on their shiny hides. I can already taste this juicy, sweet morsel as it slides down my throat. Good food is as good as a tender lover. My passionate self both amazes and delights me. It has only revealed itself within the past 5 years, because it is perhaps it is because maturity brings true courage to live fully, honestly, and gratefully.
Thank you for sharing that. That's beautiful. Did you have anything else you'd like to share with us?
That's it.
That's it? Thank you so much. I really enjoyed doing this interview. You have you've lived a wonderful and robust life. And it's very
absolutely, dear. Absolutely. And the next few years, I've been told, Spirit has told me that I will live to be at least 90, that I will be married once more with the dream, with the love of my life, with the man of my dreams, and so that I just have to be patient and know that it's coming. So I've got another few years to go yet, and I'm just feeling just fine.
That's great. Yeah, I hope I have as much energy and passion as you do when I get to be as young as you are.
Did you need any pictures of me, or do you have any?
Actually, I was going to ask you if you would mind being photographed, and if not, I will let the project manager in Panama know, and she'll contact you and set up a day that maybe we could.
Okay, because otherwise, I could send you a picture of me that I just took on my birthday in July, I can email it to you.
Well, do send it. I mean, of course, if you'd still like to be photographed, that'd be great. But definitely send a picture.
Why don't we do it this way? Why don't I send it to you? And if it's usable, we'll just leave it at that. If you think that I would, want to do something else, we can do that. It's up to you.
Okay.
But I'll email it to you. In fact, I'll email it to you as soon as I get off the phone, and you can take a look at it.
Okay, great. Okay, well, I just want to get just some demographic information before you go.
Okay.
Have your year of birth. You were born on July 8th, 1940. What was the last level of school you completed?
I'm sorry, which was, a master's degree plus. I have a master's degree plus. If I wanted to go on, I would probably take a year if I wanted to do a PhD, but I'm not interested. I'm happy with where I am. So I've completed a master's degree with about 30 additional units beyond that.
Okay.
And I have a secondary teaching credential. I have a community college teaching credential as well.
Mm-hmm. And your profession, you're teaching, right? Well, you're off,
yes.
but
that's my profession. I am a teacher.
Okay. And you live in, what's the name of your neighborhood in Panama?
Ciudad Radial. C-I-U-D-A-D, mm-hmm. And then R-E-A-L, and then comma, Juan Diaz, because it's Ciudad Radial Juan Diaz, J-U-A-N, and then D-I-A-Z.
Okay. And I have you at 6421 Calle 12?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And you live in, and that's in Panama City?
Yeah, it's part of Panama City.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's everything on my part. Anything else before I go? Anything at all? You can finally email me.
No, everything is good. Are you publishing the birth date?
No, I don't think so. I think that's just sort of for just record keeping.
Because these men don't know my age, and I don't tell them any different. They just assume that, they assume that I'm in my late 40s or early 50s, and so I just let them keep on thinking what they want to think.
Oh, my goodness. No, we won't. I think it's just for just sort of record-keeping purposes. So.
Okay, dear. Well, I'm going to get that picture and send it to you right this minute, and then you can decide on whether you still want me to do a picture here in Panama, because I've changed my look a little bit, but it's only temporary.
Okay.
So what I'm sending you is me. It's really me, because I just took it on my birthday in July.
Okay, good. Well, yes, definitely send that. And if we need anything, I'll let Nyasha know and she'll contact you.
Okay, Destiny, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
It's been a pleasure talking
to you.
You
brought, you helped me to bring back some really wonderful memories.
Oh, well, you've been inspirational to me, so thank you for sharing your story with me.
You are most welcome, dear.
Okay.
Well, take
care.
Have a good day.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.